Hey, podcasters, welcome to another edition of Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. I'm your host, Mestral, joined once again by special co-host Jill Simonello.
Hello, how are you doing this morning?
If they came off a little awkward intros, because we're having computer problems today. So third time's a charm. So as you hang with us here as we walk through the technical difficulties of recording audio, one from Chicago, one from Nebraska. Apparently it's more than my computer could handle this morning.
It's Thursday. I have no... And by the way, like, how did it get to be Thursday?
I have no idea. I've been working like crazy, and all of a sudden, bam, here you go.
Thursday.
And here's another question for you. How is it all of a sudden the 2018 models are on the marketplace?
I'm not ready for 2018, are you?
No, none at all. What was the first what was the first model year you tested as a journalist? This is kind of a fun trivia question.
First model year I tested as a journalist would have been 2003.
Yeah, you've been doing it longer than I have. I think I was like, I want to say 2011 was the first model year. 2011, 2012, something like that.
So I'd like to point out that I actually started writing about cars when I was like 10 years old. So that's how I've been able to be doing this longer than you.
Did you draw little pictures too to go with your articles?
Yeah, I did actually.
You're fantastic. That's another thing Joe reveals in the podcast. Besides goosing and feeling violated, we have that she was drawing cars and writing stories way back in the day.
All right. Wait.
Then we're not going to.
Because I'm really only like 25. So.
Right.
You know.
I've heard that the shorter you are, the slower you age. Is that appropriate?
Well, actually, I have a picture hanging on my wall in my office that gets older as I get younger. Dorian Gray reference, if anybody gets that. I was a lit major in college, so which I attended when I was 11, by the way. Because, again, keeping with the whole Sorry. It's Thursday. We'll just go back to that.
You know what? Actually, if we talk about truck news on this podcast. trying to get my head back around. All right. So let's get back to truck news. So I referenced 2018. I did it for a purpose. I actually have a real purpose behind that.
A purpose.
Yesterday, Ford, the truck maker, you know, we all know Ford. I didn't know if there's a Dorian Gray reference. I didn't need to go there. All right, so Ford, the truck maker, had released the 2018 specs on its new F-150. So a while ago, they showed it off. I think last year in the auto show, they showed it off what it looked like. Today, they revealed the specs, and I know there's some driving going on today as well. So basically, the big news here is everything's better. There you go. There it is. Moving on. No, actually, they've improved the payload, the towing, the fuel economy, and there's more standard features. So I'm going to go through the quick hits highlights that's on our website, pickuptrucktalk.com. You can look at all the articles, all the information there. A lot of it's from press release, but I put the quick hits up there because I think those are pretty handy. And there's photos. You can look at all the beautiful look of the Ford. It's got the second generation 2.7 liter EcoBoost. That's a very, very small V6 EcoBoost. It's got the EPA estimated rating of 20 city, 26 highway, 22 mile per gallon combined, which is pretty darn good out of a pickup. Here's the tow rating is 13,200 pounds of tow rating. This is pretty interesting. Most people consider half tons of tow about 10,000 pounds maximum. So 13,200 is quite a bit more than 10,000 pounds. It's featuring standard auto start stop. Woo! Standard. It's got the expanded availability of a 10-speed transmission, and it's got the if you use the available pre-collision assist with pedestrian detection and adaptive cruise control with stop-start functionality, it can like literally drive you in congested traffic. All right. So and it's got available Wi-Fi hotspots. So there's your big news. So there's a couple things to point out on this is that I think they did next generation, the 3.5 liter EcoBoost and the 5 liter V8 as well is all brand new. I will look at that. Oh, no, it's like the second generation. So the 2.7 liter EcoBoost is new. 3.5 liter is carryover and the enhanced 5 liter V8 boasts best in class payload capacity of 3,270 pounds. There's a few things I'd like to point out on this article is that A, if you ever decide to tow 13,200 pounds with a half ton truck, you need to really, really examine your head because that is a tremendous amount of weight to use in a half ton. And I don't think anybody should be towing that much with that. The half ton frame just isn't built for that. Yes, it could do it. There's this thing in journalism we say that just because you can doesn't mean you should. And that's exactly
Yes.
the point here. It's 13,200 pounds. I mean, go ahead, tow it. I would not feel comfortable doing that. I'd feel more comfortable in the Super Duty than I would the 13,000 in the half ton in 13,000. I'd also like to point out the 2.7 liter EcoBoost is interesting in that the fuel economy of it, I think they said it best gasoline and diesel as well. It's a very interesting truck in the 2.7 liter. I've never driven one. I've talked to guys who've driven one. I've wanted to drive one. Ford doesn't do a lot with me and driving stuff. But I've wanted to drive one, and I think it's a very interesting play in the marketplace of saying, hey, here's a full-size truck with a very small engine meant for fuel economy. Yeah, you can tow with it. Yeah, you can haul with it. You can do standard truck things with it. But the majority of time, it's going to be used as a empty bed. It's just going to be used for driving around to job sites, not carrying a whole lot of, but needing that truck cab and trucks. Look, I interviewed a guy about a year ago who's in Louisiana who was a pool manufacturer or not manufacturer. This is Thursday, all over the place. He was a pool salesman, and we'd go out and talk to consumers about pools and do maintenance and do the maintenance kind of contracts and stuff. And he literally told me he bought the 2.7 liter EcoBoost because of the fact that he needed the image of the truck. He said he drove to people's pool sites. They wanted the pool, and he drove up in a car, and he could just tell on their faces they didn't want to deal with him. But if he drove up in a truck, he gave the persona that he was a working guy and that he was part of a working team. And so yeah, he's like, look, he goes, I'm hauling brochures. Like, I'm not hauling stuff around. He goes, but I have to get that persona out. So when I think of the 2.7 liter, that's what I think about with that. I think that's where that customer is. And the other news is the diesel version. It's a where's it at? It's a 3 liter diesel, and it's going to come out in the spring of next year. Be the first diesel ever engine offered for the F-150 ever. It's going to be interesting to see how the consumers like that and how the EPA likes that. I mean, EPA is suing everybody right now over diesel issues.
Yes, they are.
So yeah, so I don't think overall much has changed. I mean, you could do the 2.7 liter, you can get the in the two wheel drive, you can get 26 miles per gallon. The other engines, the 3.5 liter still gets 25 mile per gallon. The 5 liter gets 23 mile per gallon. I know that the EcoBoost engines are typically faster engines and they're more fun to drive, but the V8 still sells pretty well, even though in the last year, I think the EcoBoost engines eclipsed the V8 sales, and so for Ford, and so they're really pushing them, and they're doing a lot of good work with them. I mean, they're a lot of fun to drive. I enjoy driving them. I will note, and it's probably why I don't get invited to things. I cannot get the fuel economy numbers on a Ford EcoBoost truck. I can't do it. Now, that could very much be because I like to drive them and they're fun to drive and I put my foot in the pedal, but I just can't do it. So I know other people have, and there's my statement, and there's my not getting invites to Fords. All right, so.
I never get fuel economy numbers in anything, by the way.
Oh,
Never.
you d
Well, I would take
really?
that back. I when I talk about the Ram 1500 coming up, there's a
Mm-hmm.
little bit of a surprise there. But no, I very rarely get fuel economy numbers in the vehicles that I'm driving. Very rarely. I'm a lead foot, and I'm in the city with tons of stops and starts.
Yeah. Well, they have that stop start technology, I think, is supposed to help that, right?
It doesn't. It's a lie. It is a total lie. I mean, I'm not living in a vacuum, and it doesn't work. Because I literally, like, one time somebody's like, "Well, Jill, you would get better fuel economy if you just would stop turning off that feature." And I'm like, "Okay, I'll take your bluff, and I'll test it out." And no, I did not get better fuel economy. And let me tell you, I was like annoyed for like a half an hour driving down Belmont Avenue from the lake to where I live. And stop signs and stoplights, and it turned off and turned back on. And I no, I did not get better fuel economy. I'm just gonna put that out there. It's a lie.
Okay. For the record, Jill had six eye rolls in that statement there. I think that's a new podcast record. So, yeah, so there we go. I have gotten the same feel. All right, we got to stay on task here. This is going to be a really long
Okay.
podcast if we don't stay on task. But yes, EcoBoost, a lot of fun to drive and have a great time with it. And
Yes.
I probably drive it too fast. I can't get the fuel economy numbers. It's probably just me because I just enjoy driving it. It's a fun truck.
I will agree with you on the EcoBoost. It's a great engine. So.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Let's move on, unless you feel like talking about towing 13,200 pounds in half ton.
I know I get nothing on that.
Right. Let's move on to the Grand Cherokee Trackhawk, which you're doing something next week on this, but the news today is that the 2018 Grand Cherokee Trackhawk pricing is out. And I normally don't talk about pricing because pricing is kind of a boring topic. But I'm talking about pricing on this one because it's a big thing. It starts at $85,900 for a Grand Cherokee. This is the Trackhawk. It's the most powerful and quickest SUV ever. And it's got track in its name. Hello, there's your sign. It's got track in its name. So $85,900 for this. The point that's made is that is more than the Ballyhooed Dodge Demon that they just came out with. That is $84,995. Wow, that is a lot of money for an SUV. What do you think? You got the pocket change ready to go buy one? 85,900. There you go, ready to go. And you know that's going to be done full price.
I'll take two.
There'll be no incentives on that. That'll be full
No.
price and probably some dealer markup on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it'll be limited run, and I'll be very curious to see also, like, so with the Dodge Demon, they didn't want people to, the dealers to mark it up. So with the Demon, they are actually saying, okay, for those people who charge more, you're last on the list to get the vehicle. And so they actually wanted people to either charge at, MSRP or below for the vehicles. And those who had the lower price points were actually getting their allotment of vehicles first, faster than the ones who were upcharging. So I'll be curious to see if with the Trackhawk, if they would do something similar to that, because that is a pretty steep price. Now there's nothing that says that I can't buy it for, a Dodge Demon for $84,000 and then sell it for $100,000, but the dealers themselves can't mark it up. So I don't know. But I mean, so we were talking before the podcast that the average transaction price for a truck, at least, is around $46,000. And for a car, it's $34,000. So I mean, you and I say, oh my gosh, $84,000, $85,000. But, clearly, people are spending a lot of money on their vehicles.
Very clearly. I mean, there are people that just really want this and they'll buy it. It's got the Hellcat engine in it. It's a fun engine to drive. I've driven the Hellcat, Dodge Charger Hellcat, and it's a great engine. I don't know. That's a lot for a non-luxury SUV. That is a lot of money.
Well, but I mean, the Grand Cherokee has a lot of nice, luxurious elements, and I imagine, they're not going to strip it. It's going to be like
Right,
the
it'll be.
tier trim with all of the, heated steering wheel, heated seats, rear heated seats. And I'm not looking at a spec sheet or anything like that. I'm just assuming that it's going to have every whistle and bell possible. Talk to me in a couple of weeks, and I'll be able to tell you not only all of the amenities and features, but I'll tell you how it drives on a racetrack.
Yeah,
So,
you're gonna do that racetrack
coming
with
soon.
it. Yes, that I think that's gonna be a lot of fun. So I can't wait to hear more about that. The third item on our list, we had some really big news items, and then we have a couple recalls. We gotta talk about the recalls, but we have another big news item is that Toyota and Mazda have decided to kind of do some joint partnership here. Each one's gonna buy some shares of each other. They're gonna co-develop and co-occupy a plant in the U.S. They're gonna build. It's gonna be like. My gosh, what is it? $1.6 billion, a U.S. plant. They're gonna look around and find the site, and so every state out there is like, hey, come on over to Louisiana, like, oh, come on to Texas. They keep getting these guys. The big news for us, though, and on this podcast, is that they've made another decision that was kind of under the radar on the press release. You kind of look a little bit different at it. It was they were building a plant in Mexico as well, and they were gonna open that in 2019, and this plant in Mexico was going to build the Corolla. And Toyota said, nope, we're not going to build the Corolla there in that plant in Mexico. We're going to build the Tacoma in Mexico. And what's interesting here is I just read a news story. They had to push it back to 2020 because their suppliers aren't ready to build a Tacoma there. But the Tacoma will be built at this plant. it's going to be the year after the Baja Mexico plant comes online to build more Tacomas. And so what you'll have is you'll have half a plant in San Antonio, you have a full plant in Mexico, and then a knockdown facility in the Baja that will actually increase, they'll produce more Tacomas there as well. So this is going to be interesting because these plants can build up to 150,000 vehicles a year. Currently, Toyota builds about 120, I think it's 120, 130,000 Tacomas. It's not, what my point here is, it's not enough to fill a full facility, right? That's why it's half in San Antonio and half, and the other half Baja. So you can have one facility in Mexico that's building all Tacomas. And Tacoma is sold in South America, and it's sold in the U.S. And I know Toyota, I've talked to Bill Fay on this. He's the head guy in North America, besides Jim Lance. He's one guy below him. I think sales guy or something like that is his official title. Him and I were talking once, and he talked about how they were under demand by about 30%. Now, the midsize truck market has exploded. There's a lot more players in the midsize truck market. Things are exploding up. But you're going to build 100, say they can produce 200,000, say 150,000 at the plant in Mexico, and say another 70,000 or so in the Baja facility. So 200 and some thousand Tacomas, and maybe they'll meet demand. The big story here is what happens in San Antonio, right? So if you take half the production out of that San Antonio plant, take it to Mexico, Tacoma goes away, Tundra's there. Are we going to see Toyota actually get serious on trucks? They've been a car maker that's been resistant to doing trucks. Their new Camry came out and they said, we're going to reinvigorate the midsize car market because it's been boring. The Camry's going to take over. So now you have all these trucks going to Mexico. Half the plant is going to be Tundra and the other half is going to be vacant. And they're not going to lay off employees. I've been to that San Antonio plant. That's not going to happen. And I know it's all speculation at this point, right? They're going to build Tacomas in Texas and Mexico, two places. I don't think so. I don't think there's enough demand there. So what do they build in Texas? Are they going to build a diesel Tundra? Ooh. If I type this story up right now, I'll get a bunch of clicks right tomorrow. Are they going to build a heavy-duty half-ton Tundra? Are they going to bring the FJ Cruiser back? Ooh. I've heard through the grapevine that the Toyota Sequoia is going away because the mild updates were pretty much boring that they released in Chicago. And the sales on that has been terrible, so they could open up more production there as well. So Toyota and Mazda are going to join up. They're going to build a plant. They're going to move to Tacoma production. They're going to do some fun things. What's great about this is that I hope that it works this way, is that they wanted to build an EV tech together. Because Mazda can't afford to develop their own EV technology. But I really hope that, as we've talked about in this podcast many times, is that Mazda takes their driving excitement of their vehicles and adds that to Toyota's. And then, you know, like, Toyota takes their EV and gives that to Mazda, right? So you have this perfect joining of what's best in both brands and bring them together. So I don't know. It's very interesting news. Did you have any take on it besides what I just spewed out for the last 10 minutes?
I mean, it's not so much truck related, but for me, I mean, as we've talked about before, I'm a bit of a Mazda fangirl, and I love everything Mazda does. I love how they drive. I love how they look. I think they've been doing an amazing job. And so my takeaway from this is, woohoo, more Mazdas on the road, because they are a small automaker. They don't have the capability to produce a huge volume of vehicles. And so this just kind of opens up their world. And I feel like they have I heard in the news, I think, that they have another new crossover planned.
That's what's supposed to come out of this plant they're going to build with Toyota. Yeah. They're going to build a crossover.
Yeah. So, you know, that to me is exciting. I'm actually driving the Mazda CX-5 right now. And, you know, I was at the launch program for the vehicle and loved it. And, like, I've only had it for a couple of days now. And I'm just like, yeah, now I remember why I loved it. Right now, the Mazda lineup is amazing. And so this, to me, is exciting because I'm like, yes, more people are going to have the opportunity to experience the awesomeness that is Mazda.
Okay, and
that's Jill, my takeaway.
That's Jill Mazda fangirl at Simonello.
Yeah, right?
So I think it's very exciting. I think it's perfect for both companies. I think they both do something really well. Toyota builds really quality vehicles on a large scale. And Mazda builds fun-to-drive vehicles in a very smaller scale. So I think they can bring those two together and developed the EV, which is really expensive these days. And the ongoing story on this is if you read some of the business articles on the automotive industry, is that they all predict that there'll be less automakers going forward. As technology gets more expensive, as EV gets more expensive, they feel like that there'll be more consolidation within the marketplace. I don't know. It's an interesting take, and it makes sense to us because they are pretty expensive. You ever open the hood on an EV vehicle like a Leaf or a Prius and looked around? It's a lot of money involved in developing that. So, all right, so that's enough for me. You got some recalls. Hit the recall news, Jill. Let us have it.
Hit it.
Hit it.
Hit it. Well, I just saw a notice come through today from Nissan. They're actually recalling 52,000 pickup trucks from the Titan. So it's XD and the regular Titan from 2016, 2017 model years, the crew cab and crew cab, so both crew cabs. And it's because the rear passenger's head could come into contact with a part of the rear seatbelt assembly in a crash. So, not if you don't ever carry rear passengers, maybe not something imminent or immediate, but certainly something that could be very harmful if you don't get it taken care of. So that was something that came across my desk today. Was the Nissan Titan recall. And then earlier this, well, I guess it was probably, was it last week? Because I don't think we did a podcast last week.
No, we did not.
We saw that General Motors is actually recalling 800,000 GMC Sierras and Chevrolet Silverado pickup trucks. So this recall is actually could potentially be problematic. As I'm reading from the AP article, the company says the vehicles can temporarily lose electric power steering assist, especially during low speed turns. If that happens, the driver could lose control of the steering wheel. So you lose control of the steering wheel and crash ensues. So this recall is actually affecting trucks from the 2014 model year. So it says most of the trucks, so like 700,000 were sold in the US, 100,000 sold elsewhere, but huge recall for the 2014 Chevrolet Silverado, and this is the 1500. So it's Silverado 1500 and Sierra 1500.
So the half tons will have could potentially have problems with losing the steering wheel. That's not a good thing.
No.
All right, there's your news. Don't lose your steering wheel. Get your Chevy taken care of, or your GMC Sierra, and don't hurt your passengers. Get your Titan taken care of. And we'll be back with more Pickup Truck Plus SUV talk. And welcome back for just a quick segment here. This is something unusual we're gonna do. We're just talking a little bit about seat belts because of the Nissan Titan recall we talked about, and Jill has an interesting story on this.
So this week, the IIHS, so the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, they released a study talking about do you buckle up in the back seat? And the answer is a lot of people do, but 25% or so of people do not buckle up in the back seat. And people are like, oh, well, I feel safer in the back seat. I don't necessarily need to buckle up. But the interesting thing that I wanted to mention here, because I will not start my car if people don't buckle up in the back seat. And I just, I'm just trying to be safe for everybody in the vehicle. But turns out there's much more self-interest in it for the driver to make your back seat passengers back up. Because if your back passenger doesn't buckle up, think about this for a second. What happens in an accident? That person goes flying. Where do they go flying? Into the driver's seat. So basically, I as I'm look, I'm like, if I remember correctly, drivers are twice as likely to be fatally injured, aka killed, in an accident if their backseat passenger is not buckled up.
So there you have it. With the
Yeah.
safety news this week and the don't die, make sure your
Yeah.
other people buckle up.
Yeah. I mean, and it's funny because the study goes on and they're like, well, what would make you buckle up in the back seat? And people basically said, well, if somebody in the car reminded me, I'd buckle up. Or if the driver could get pulled over by the cops, if I'm not wearing my seatbelt, I would buckle up. So I don't know. All you have to do as a driver is remind your backseat passengers to buckle up. And all you have to do is look in the rearview mirror and see if they're actually buckled up.
So let's keep going this theme. I have a few points as well to make this. In my area, I've learned that seatbelts are optional for most people, which just boggles my mind. If you're one of those people who wants to argue about whether seatbelts are good or bad, just stop. There's no argument anymore. Yes, you could potentially be flipped over in a car, going under the water, and a seatbelt could trap you under the car. The odds of that versus dying in an auto accident or being seriously injured without your seatbelt on are just so minimal. It's not even worth the argument there. It drives me nuts to see people driving around without seatbelts. I see it all the time. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. The other thing I'd make is it's come out a little bit this week. Cars.com did a story, and a couple other people are doing stories. Is the people that put their feet up on the dash. So the passenger riding in your vehicle puts the feet up on a dash. My dad used to do this. My dad would roll down the window, stick his feet out the window, right?
Ah.
Right. Well, so it turns out not a good idea. Not a good idea at all.
Really, really bad idea.
Right. And so you can literally be paralyzed if you have your feet on the dash in an accident. Because where are those feet going to go? They're going to go right back in your chest and they could pretty much snap in half.
So when you think about it, the reason is the airbag, when you're in an accident, it will deploy. And if you have your feet on the dash, it basically, I don't know the pound feet of torque or whatever the force that the airbag deploys, but it's pretty violent. So your feet are there. Throws your knee into your face, breaks your nose, breaks. We actually published a story this week. A woman in, I want to say in Nashville, was trying to warn people against putting their feet on the dash. She did it. Her husband told her not to. She did it. They were in an accident. She broke her femur in half. Mm-hmm. She broke her nose. I think she broke her collarbone. 2 years later, she's still walking with a limp, trying to recover from this accident. And the kicker is the emergency room doctor told her that if she had had her feet on the floor, she would have walked away from that completely uninjured.
So the real takeaway from that story is always listen to your husband.
No.
But seriously, people, stop doing it.
Yeah.
Stop. It's not.
Not only does it look awful as you're driving past and you see somebody's bare feet on a dashboard and you just make, it just makes other people around you go, ew. But you could be seriously injured.
Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah.
So we have to keep this podcast going. All right. Anyways,
short segment for the day.
Short segment. We have another unique story coming up. I was in Cincinnati. I was recently on a work family trip, and I found out about a truck in Cincinnati. We drove down and viewed it, and this truck is a Cheviota Priuk. And no, I didn't mispronounce that. That's what it is. It's a Cheviota Priuk. And I'm interviewing the owner, and it's up next on Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. And we're back with more Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. I'm here talking to Joe Winters, who's got a 46 Chevy, just a basic truck. So how you doing, Joe? Welcome to the program.
I'm doing great. How you doing today?
No, we're fantastic. There's just one little difference with this 46 Chevy. It's a Prius. It's a Prius combination with a Chevy. So talk us through. What did you do here?
All right. So I picked up this 46 Chevy truck. It came out of Kansas, and I was trying to decide what to do with it. So I was looking at a 350-350 combo, but that's boring. And I run into a friend. He had a Cadillac Northstar front-wheel drive 49 International pickup. And so, long story short, I ended up picking up a Prius off of him. I did a, similar to a subframe clip, attaching the 46 frame to the 2002 Prius. And so now I have a front-wheel drive hybrid Cheviota Priuk.
Yes. It's a very unique truck. I'm going to say it's not a Frankenstein. It actually rides like a Prius, and it rides nice, and it looks like a really cool old truck. We're doing some video earlier, and we got stopped a few times trying to do some video. People wandering around want to look at the truck. Nice patina finish. So the big question was why, but I think you answered that. The why was a curiosity, something different. You've done a lot of different modifications over the years, and this was just something unique?
Yeah, it's just trying to do something that is not white noise. There's just a lot of stuff out there that's similar to the next, and I wanted to see if I could get good fuel economy. I've always been interested in electric vehicles. And when I learned a little bit more about the way the hybrid technology works, I wanted to give it a shot.
And speaking of fuel economy, you haven't done the numbers yet because you have a 1-ton rear axle set up. So you got to drop some weight. We got to take some leaf swings out. So you don't, not sure we're going to get yet, but you're hoping for 35 to 40?
35 to 40 is my hope. I am 500 pounds over a stock Prius curb weight right now. I think with some of the stuff that I'm going to do to it, I'll probably drop another 250 off of that. So I'll be about a passenger's weight away from stock. And I'm hoping to be in the 35 to 40 range, but I'm dealing with some aerodynamic differences as well.
Sure. It's a little bit taller than a Prius and just different setup. What was the most challenging part of this build?
Definitely the wiring harness, dealing with all of that. There's miles and miles of wire in a Prius. You've got multiple different computers that are doing different functions. And so the wiring was definitely the biggest setback. As far as the bringing the frames together and matching that was surprisingly easy. That came together well.
Yeah, you actually mentioned that the steering wheel column and the brakes and everything kind of just lined right up.
Yeah, when I put the two frames together, I had to stack the 46 about 3.5 inches taller than the Prius frame, if you can call it that, unibody structural support. And then when I ran the column in, it actually ran directly to the gearbox on the Prius. And then the brake pedal is just a lengthening of the pedal and bringing it up through the floor of the 46, and it just lined up perfect.
And so when you've taken this out in different places, your goal is you're going to drive into an auto show. People are going to think it's a 46, but then it's like, oh, wait a minute, it's not a 46. It's a Prius Blue. What kind of response have you gotten?
Well, I wasn't sure what I would run into, whether it be haters or guys that would actually get the joke, but everybody has appreciated it. I've not had anybody come up to me and be negative yet. I've had some negative stuff online, but for the most part, the person-to-person interaction has been nothing but positive.
Were you surprised at all when you got it to run, turn over? Does anything stand out to you as far as when you're driving it around?
The comfort, for sure. It is incredibly comfortable to drive. It feels like a Prius car. It's a little stiff in the rear end right now, but I can fix that. It was incredibly comfortable. It just came together really well.
Yeah, and you have the AC, you have the heating in here ready
That's
to
right.
go. You have, I mean, all the modern stuff that a Prius offers. You put the dash in behind the original dash.
Yep.
I mean, you just welded them both together, actually mirrored them both together on top of each other really well.
Yeah, that came together well. I'm running the headlights and turn signals and taillights are all Prius wiring harness. Everything just is, it's all Prius except for the cab and the flatbed.
And you and I were talking earlier, this wasn't a long build. You were done pretty quick.
I actually started in December of 2016. I brought the Prius into the garage and started taking it apart then. And I was test driving it around my parking lot, I believe in March. And then I brought it back in, had proof of concept, started taking it back apart, restructuring everything, making sure that was correct. And then I'm driving it in May.
That's an incredible build. There's a lot of auto manufacturers wish they had that kind of build speed. And so you've driven a total of 40 miles, but your
yes.
goal is to get about a couple hours up different auto shows?
I would like to be able to cruise anywhere in Ohio, which there's shows up in Toledo. I'd like to go to Columbus, and that's 2 to 3 hour drives.
And have you had it up to speed at like a 60?
Oh, yeah,
well,
I've run it
as
down.
Far as you know, because speedometer is a little bit of an issue. But
well, I use an app on my phone to tell me what my speed is, and I've run down the highway at 70 mile an hour, and it just tracks like a car. No problems. Pulls itself right along. Plenty of power. In fact, I estimate that I have more power with the Prius power plant than the original 216 six-cylinder would have had back in the post-war days.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure you do. You probably, I mean, it's be silly to put on a dynamometer because you have the numbers from the Prius.
Right.
So there's no really need to dyno it. I mean, it'd be difference as far as weight, but, you know, as far as we rode around all day, it's smooth power as like you said, drives around the Prius. There's no differences there. And the exterior we're going to leave the same. It's going to have a nice patina shell to it. It just has that really cool factor plus the Prius below.
Yeah. I just wanted to see if I could do something that was very drivable, economical, but it looked cool.
Yeah, so make sure you make it to Ohio. Make sure you check out the auto shows. He'll be at a few of these, and we'll be back with more Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. And finally, we're back with the last segment. I promise you, this is the last segment of today's show.
And we are not going to digress at all.
No, no. And thanks for staying with us. Make sure you email comments at tim@pickuptrucktalk.com about how long the show is and how much you dislike that. But if you're having fun, stay with us because we're having a good time here. We want to wrap the show about vehicles we're doing and what we've been driving. And we're going to start with Jill and then go to me. I have a road trip story for you. Jill, this was fun. We didn't podcast last week because I was in a tent in Wisconsin and kind of couldn't do it. But Jill had a Ram pickup. And what's exciting about this, it's very exciting to me, is this is Jill's first time having a Ram pickup as a loan. Note, she's driven them at events. She's driven them at different places. But this is the first time living with it for a week, testing if it's going to fit in the garage, doing all the kind of stuff that Jill does with trucks, seeing how the gear shifter interacts with her, interrupts her life of dealing with the air conditioning system. So, Jill, how was the Ram pickup?
So really, I think before I get into how the Ram pickup truck was, I have to say the really exciting part of this loan isn't that this is the first time that I've driven a Ram pickup truck in a week-long test. It is because I got the Ram pickup truck loan as a direct result of talking about not having driven the Ram pickup truck in a loan on this podcast.
Yes. So, the people listen to this podcast. I don't know if you knew that. They actually do. It's kind of a random thing. I'm shocked by it personally.
Well, I mean, and the podcast is doing really well so far. So, but I just wanted to point it out. The exciting thing is that I actually got this loan as a direct result of talking about not having a loan on this podcast. So that is me not digressing, from the point, on this lovely Thursday morning. I had the night edition, the crew cab 4x4. It was beautiful. The exterior is great. It was like this shiny bright red with the blacked out wheels and, you know, the black accents and the blacked out grill. Beautiful exterior. Loved how it looked. Did try to fit it into my garage and I'm sad to say that it did not work. I missed it by about 3 inches. I had my husband literally standing in the back of the garage and he'd be, you know, the sensors are like, you know, going crazy. I was like, stop. And my husband's like, no, you can come back. You can come back. And like, literally we're in within a half an inch of the back wall of my garage. And, I got out of the truck and I looked and it was like 3 inches beyond where the garage door would shut. So, it did not fit in my garage. I was parking on the street, unfortunately, this past week, but managed to find a nice kind of off-street parking, if that makes sense. And but yeah, so very, very big. Did not fit in the garage, but comfortable to drive. I was, you know, the more I'm driving pickup trucks, I used to be really intimidated to drive them in the city. And the more I drive them, the more comfortable, obviously, I'm getting with them. But this one was pretty easy to drive and maneuver. I thought the turning radius was really good. And the engine, oh my God, it had a 5.7 liter V8 Hemi. And like just the sound of that engine, it was like, brrr. And I would turn a corner and floor it. It was amazing. So I alluded to this earlier. So the fact that I am a bit of a lead foot, I actually met the combined fuel economy. So the fuel economy in this is 15 miles per gallon in the city, 21 miles per gallon on the highway, and then the combined fuel economy of 17. And I will say I did drive up to Michigan and back, but I did a lot of city driving. Running errands, going to the grocery, going to the gym, heading to the lakefront for runs, that kind of stuff. And so I think it was a pretty good mix of really evenly combined driving. And I literally walked away with like 17.1 miles per gallon on the vehicle. So hit the combined. I got the truck, drove up to Michigan and back pretty much 100% highway driving, and I was averaging, it wasn't 21, it was about 20 miles per gallon, but I was impressed that I hit 20. Right. And then, like I said, when I turned the vehicle in, I was at about 17.1 miles per gallon. So for me, that's really big news. We talk about, you know, being a lead foot, never hitting the EPA fuel economy estimates. And so, I mean, technically, I want to say that hitting 17.1 means that I hypermiled by 0.1 miles per gallon in the pickup truck. So I just, you know, I'm just going to put that out there. I was hypermiling in a Ram 1500, but, no, this, you know, it was a very nice vehicle. So the base price for the Ram, Night Edition was $43,995. This tester added, a lot of extras. Had the convenience group, the premium audio system, the engine actually was an upsell, and it had four corner air suspension, so it speaks to the handling, and the Ram Box cargo management system, which, by the way, I do fit in the Ram Box. We've talked about that before. There's photographic proof. But so all told, all in, the as tested price of the vehicle was $57,395. So, again, when you're talking about the average transaction price of a full size pickup truck being $46,000, you know, it's a little bit more than that, but probably not completely crazy. And, the exterior is beautiful. I think I mentioned to Tim offline, I didn't love the interior. It had some nice features. Like, it had a really nice cell phone holder that I thought was a brilliant idea. More manufacturers should do that kind of thing. But the interior overall just seemed a little bit cheap to me and plasticky. And I really disliked the placement of where the USB ports were. They were inside the center console on the, like, it had a two-layer center console area, and it was on the top layer of the center console. And so cord management was a little bit weird if you were going to store your phone in the little cell phone holder. But so that was weird. They did have two USB ports, so yay. And heated things, you know, heated seats and steering wheels and that kind of stuff, which, you know, even at 90 degrees in Chicago, I still use. Overall, I really liked how it drove. I liked how it looked. I thought the interior could have been a little bit better, but, you know, overall, very pleased with the vehicle.
Yeah. Well, it does my heart good to hear you say that you enjoy driving pickup trucks around the city. I'm getting through making you a truck girl out of you. At this point. So I'm thinking in my head, though, since you mentioned this in the podcast of how you got the truck by saying on the podcast, what other product should we start talking about to make sure we get his little press? I want a Mercedes-Benz G-Wagon, darn it. Give me the G-Wagon.
Right? What do I even want to drive that I do? So we have to say, though, too, that part of the limitations of, is the fleet vehicles of where we live, too. So, like, living in Chicago, I probably have more access to a wider range of vehicles than you would have living in Nebraska. But if you lived in Detroit or LA, like, the world is your oyster. And you have even more vehicles available at your fingertips. Yeah. So
there is a challenge there. There's the con, though, is in those areas, there's a lot of big publications. So you're small fish in big sea. But that's kind of behind the scenes. So let's keep going on the what podcast going on. I took a road trip, and that's why we didn't do the podcast last week. I was on the road. I took a Total Land Cruiser out to Michigan with my family of four, and we drove around in Insane Cliffs Off-Road Park in Illinois, which that was pretty interesting. And then we drove over to my dad's house and picked up a Chevy Silverado pickup that had the High Desert package, and then we drove back home in the Nissan Pathfinder. So a couple points I'll make about each vehicle. Land Cruiser, my wife asks me every day how we can afford the vehicle for her to buy. She just is enthralled by the thing, which is interesting because it's a really high-seated off-road vehicle with a big, thirsty V8 engine in it. So it's very. She just likes the hot ride height. I think there's a point in time where women feel like they feel more safe when they're up higher, and they feel like they're more control. Which is interesting. If you want to check out our Facebook page, I'm going to share a link on there. I just wrote a controversial story about are lifted pickups more dangerous. So in crash testing, which I'm going to grab my bunker hat and sit down and sit in the corner and watch a shelling come through of comments of calling me an idiot. So there's some controversy there. The Chevy Silverado High Desert, make sure you check out the Facebook page and really do this, is that the High Desert package has an avalanche-like look to it. And if you remember the Avalanche, people still love the Avalanche. I still get asked questions all the time about the Avalanche. when it's coming back, why Chevy got rid of it. And so it's got an avalanche-like look. It actually has a Ram Box look, too. It's a drop-in bed liner. And so that was the big news there. And like I said, we drove to Cincinnati with the truck and did the Chevy Yota Priya truck, which you heard a little bit earlier in the podcast. It's really interesting. It's just, I don't know, it's just exciting to see them do that. Really stirring the fire on getting the Avalanche back up there. It's a lot of customer comments. So check it out. Check out the photos. I put all the photos up there. It's a very interesting truck. There's actually a YouTube video as well where I talk about the rear end of the High Desert package. It was, and the other interesting part, talk about fuel economy, was it was a 6.2 liter V8 with the 8-speed transmission, which is usually a very thirsty engine. They offered a 5.3 and a 6.2. Usually you can't get fuel economy numbers. We got, I believe it was 20 miles per gallon highway. Well, because Jovis is standing back, reset the trip meter. 20 miles per gallon, 6.2 liters, pretty darn good.
Yes.
That was exciting. And then the Nissan Pathfinder, I'll say a few notes about this. It's third row Pathfinder, third row option. What was interesting about it was, and I've doing a story on it as we speak, is that I took it off-roading, which is not something that you typically would do with a Pathfinder, because mm-hmm. the older Pathfinder used to be on body and frame. This is a new SUV unibody one. Less capable. However, it still has four-wheel drive. And so we went to a snowmobile trail up in the UP and lowered down the tires, which was a fun experience. It was just waiting around. And then drove it for about 20 miles, aired them back up, and then we hit the Badlands over in South Dakota. And we did the Badlands. There's a trail up there. It's called the Sheep Mountain Table Trail Road or something like that. Sheep Mountain Table. It's got to have all of them. And what was fascinating about it, there was a guy there with a Mercedes-Benz. It was a 550. And he had New York plates on it. And I was like, New York plates, 550. And so we stop at this place, and it's an overlook that you stop at. And I talked to the guy. They're from England. And he had rented this 550 to drive on their vacation. Yeah, I was a little bit like, and you drove it? Like, so a 550 Mercedes-Benz in South Dakota, and I'm talking Sturgis area. I'm talking the western part of the state, Rapid City. I don't know. I was talking to my wife about it, like, where did he fly in to pick this up at? Did he drive it out from New York? I don't think that they'd have, like, I don't see Hertz Rent-A-Car having a 550 at the Rapid City, South Dakota airport. I'm not seeing it, but maybe they do. Anyways, talking to this guy, and it was kind of fun because talking different things. And there's a trail on the west. Let's see. No, it would have been the south side of Sheep Mountain Table Road. And the trail is for high-clearance vehicles only. And so the idea is you got to have some ground clearance. And so naturally, I took the Pathfinder. What the hell? My wife was pretty nervous and upset with me since I did that because there was a couple of spots that might have been better with a lifted truck or a Jeep or something. But we powered through them. And, you know, I just kind of made it the way. And what's interesting is as we're driving along, the 550s in front of us, like, he did the same trail and he stopped. And so the 550 and the Pathfinder actually have the same amount of ground clearance. I mean, if you park them side by side, they're about the same ground clearance. He stops, turns around in the middle of the trail. He's like going through the grasses, turns around, and I pull up next to him and I'm like, what's going on? He goes, yeah, there's a big gnarly section of this trail. Like, it had gone in and the ruts had been there. And he goes, my wife won't let me go through there. So his wife was like, no, we're not doing it. She's all freaking out. And I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to do it. So I pick a good line and we go through pretty easily. And you know, at one point the Pathfinder was sliding backwards across the trail because they're kind of muddy in some ruts. And my wife was not very pleased, but we gave this stop, this overlook on the top of the trail. And it's a really beautiful overlook over the Badlands, which is a bunch of rock formations and things. And I'm taking video of it. And we have some cool video in photography I have to assemble. So we turn around and we come back, and the Pathfinder is doing fine. And incidentally, I did not air down the tires, and I didn't do it because I wanted the higher ground clearance. I didn't want to sag at all. And as we're driving back, the English couple are walking to me. They're walking the trail to me. And he walks up to me and he's like, and I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, yeah, you know, we did that and I just wouldn't do it. He says, do you know those things that they have the lane departure assist these days in cars? I'm like, yeah. He goes, I've had that for 20 years. It's called my wife. And I was like, all right, so you're only allowed. He goes, you do this more than I do, so you're good doing it. So he's like, you made it over that. You know, so he's asking me these questions. I'm like, yeah, I just picked a good line and went around it. I'm like, you know, at one point I skipped the obstacle altogether. I just kind of went up in the grass and came around. I'm like, it's native grass is in the middle of a national park. I'm not leaving ruts. No big issue there. So yeah, so we drove it back down and then we drove the road back and drove back home. We were gone 15 days. 15 days, 9 states, 4,500 miles, and 5 campsites. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. But the Pathfinder piece was just fascinating to me because people think of the Pathfinder as being the not your off-road vehicle. And the story is that vehicles these days, especially SUVs, even unibodies, are a lot more capable than people give them credit for. And mm-hmm. we've just created it as a society, we're at the point where it's like, oh, I can't take it. Oh, I can't take it, which I think is a byproduct of not understanding how to drive these vehicles and also a byproduct of how expensive the vehicles have become. So, you know, it used to be you'd buy an SUV and you could just beat it up and go off-roading with it because it was a body on frame and you felt comfortable with it and it wasn't that expensive. Now, you know, we're talking $86,000 for a Trackhawk that'll never see dirt. Because it's $86,000, that's not something you want to even try. That's not the point of that vehicle. So, I had no problem with it. I had a good time. I would have done more, but I wanted to stay married. So, it was a good nice. Adventure. It was a lot of fun taking those three different vehicles and different entertainment options. So, like the Land Cruiser had the built-in DVD players. Okay, the Silverado had Wi-Fi. The Pathfinder had nothing. I have two kids that are 7 and 5 and the boys need entertainment, so you know they learned the word Wi-Fi on this trip because they learned their Kindles didn't work without the Wi-Fi too well. They had games but they didn't want to watch movies, so it was really interesting to see the different perspectives. Like could we just, I know that stuff in about 5 years gonna be standard. I think every vehicle's gonna have Wi-Fi, every vehicle's gonna have DVD players in the top or trim levels. I think that's going to come down, but it was very interesting to see them as off-road vehicles and as family vehicles, and then as long distance vehicles. It's three different perspectives. So we had a good time. Lots to write about, lots to talk about. So make sure you follow us on the Facebook page, Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. You'll see photos of the trip. You'll see some videos I've did as we're out there. The Land Cruiser video was pretty interesting. I happened to damage that, which I really am sorry for. Kind of hit a tree. And the more stuff's coming down the line, more fun stuff. I think that's it.
So, with the Land Cruiser, did you say that you were at Cliffs Insane Terrain?
Yes.
In Illinois?
Yeah.
Is that where you damaged the vehicle?
Yeah.
So, remember that story I told you about the FJ Cruiser and getting stuck in the mud?
Yeah.
That same place.
Was that where you were at? It's, okay. All right, I can see
that. I had to get winched out by an ATV.
Place. Yeah, I can see that now. That park, by the way, is interesting in that it's basically somebody's like backyard they just want to beat up. Like the trails are like carved out. I mean, I don't know. Very interesting place.
There's a lot of ATVs there. I think there were a few Jeeps when I was there. There weren't a lot of just SUVs going to like off road, but. I asked for specific permission, but it's funny when I heard you say that, I was like, he went to that place. And, but yeah, So
there's your plug for Cliffs Insane.
You should never go to Cliffs Insane.
Yeah. Never go there. It's outside of Chicago. And the reason we did it was I wanted to go, there's a place in Indiana. I forget the name of the park in Indiana. It's western side of Indiana. And it was going to be about 3 hours out of our way. And so I had to get to Michigan. We had to swap vehicles. So I didn't have time to hit that one. So we hit this one because it's literally on the way across I-80, I think it is. It's just kind of south in the small town. If you own an ATV or if you own a motorcycle, it's a fun place to go. I mean, they have miles of trails in the back and stuff. The problem was it rained the day before, so it was pretty muddy. And I was trying to get around to a spot, do some video and do some photography. I didn't want to do a lot of massive off-roading because it's Land Cruiser. It's $90,000. Again, Trackhawk. It's not a vehicle you get dirty that often. It's not, it's not something for that price point. And I picked a spot and there was some anxiety because we had motorcycles and ATVs behind us and we were kind of hogging the trail. And so there's some anxiety. And then I hit a spot and I went down in the mud of the that was there, took the tires in with it, and it kicked the back end out, and the back end hit a tree. So it just happens. It's not, you know, nothing I had done about it. I was steering like crazy. But then we got kind of stuck, and then I had to get us getting stuck. And by the way, crawl control is a feature in the Land Cruiser, and this feature allows you to turn on a dial and it controls the transmission, the braking, and the engine horsepower, and it allows you to kind of walk your way down hills and walk your way up hills. And what was interesting with this was I got it stuck in crawl control. It would not go up a hill. It literally had to stop, back up, and then I just used the V8 and just hit the gas. And what's interesting about this crawl control is I like the feature. I've had bad luck with it. I got stuck last year at the Texas Truck Rodeo with Tacoma with crawl control, with Toyota's chief engineer with me sitting next to me in the passenger seat. And I literally had just picked a bad line. It just wasn't, and it wasn't the truck's fault. I just had picked a bad line, and I wasn't, you know.
So the moral of the story is that you should not off-road, apparently.
I had no problems with the Pathfinder. Thank you very much. There was no problems with Pathfinder. Zero issues with Pathfinder. Maybe I should. I don't know. Yeah. So if next week's show will be live from a training session I'll be having forced to go to as part of an insurance settlement with Toyota. No, it was fine. It was the vehicle will be fine. It's nothing that was damaged, can't be fixed. Just a lot of fun. So anyways, we should wrap this up. Next week, there's a couple of program notes. We have a ton of interviews scheduled, so stay with us. We have a ton of cool interviews coming up. I'm going to Woodward Dream Cruise in a week and a half, doing a Nissan, has Midnight Edition vehicles coming out. That'll be fun. Jill is doing a Trackhawk drive on the racetrack itself. That'll be a lot of fun. Stay tuned for that. I'm doing an RMD event, which is the middle of Estes Park. We're driving some vehicles up there. And then we get to September, and I should stop this. Well, let's just go live. Go live. Are you going to Montana? Did you get the final email?
I did, but I don't think I can do it now.
Oh my gosh. No, come on. Okay, we're going to talk about this online because there's a really cool event happening in Montana that we'll get to. So stay with us for more. Hit the subscribe button. Follow along Pickup Trucks Plus SUV Talk. Email me, tim@pickuptrucktalk.com. Jill and I's Twitter will be on the show notes. And we'll see you down the road.